Accession number 13271, reel 2.
Yes, I was told that not to worry about it, that the only occasion when we would be required to use it would be in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, where Russian nuclear submarines would use high speed. There would be no civilians involved, hundreds of miles from land, and that they probably wouldn't even detect it, I think was a statement that was made. I was extremely skeptical of that. But I got on with it. But it made me really begin to think about the problem of the Royal Navy and nuclear weapons. Anyway, I then went back to the training squadron at Portland. This was the seeking training squadron, and this time as the senior observer. Oh, and incidentally, I would just like to mention an accident that happened when I was in 824 squadron as senior observer. This is when we were ashore at Culdrose in Cornwall. I don't want to go into too many personal details here, but I had a marginal new observer arrive from training who had scraped through and who I had to continue to monitor carefully. And he was due to go night flying, and he went off on a simulated anti-submarine exercise in Falmouth Bay with an escort seeking, with an experienced observer in the back to keep an eye on him. But unfortunately, it was one of those nights which was very dark, and the wind was from the east. And so, if I could explain, in order to get into the dip in an anti-submarine helicopter, you have to do a transition from about 200 feet and 100 knots down to hovering at 40 feet. And this goes through an autopilot system. And it involves basically throwing off about 1 mile downwind. If you have to predict your position where you want to get into the dip, you therefore have to aim for it, and you have to actually, obviously if you're flying direct into wind, all you do is you start the transition 1 mile short. But if you're coming across wind or downwind, you have got to aim for that transition position turning into wind 1 mile before you get to your position. And, of course, if the southwesterly prevailing wind was blowing, then there was no problem in Falmouth Bay, because you were always throwing off to the east. But that night, there was an easterly wind, and so you had to throw off to the west. And this young observer, we don't know what happened, but he was clearly getting absorbed in his tactical navigation at the expense of his safety navigation. He had up front two pilots who were actually not very experienced with these local conditions. A Canadian, who although very experienced, was unfamiliar with Falmouth Bay, and a young, newly trained pilot who perhaps hadn't picked up fully these local tricks. And one of the tricks that the pilots always had was you should keep the lights of Falmouth clear of Blackhead, which was just to the south of Falmouth Bay. And this was a clearing bearing. And they did not. They didn't pick that up. And the long and the short of it was that this helicopter flew straight into Blackhead. And I was the duty officer that night. I had briefed them. And obviously, he was my baby, this young observer. And it was a total nightmare. And the fire brigade couldn't get close to it. It was a magnesium fire because of the rotor head. It's made of magnesium alloys, enormous high temperature. And it was just ashes. And I had to go. My commanding officer had four deaths on his hands, and including a Canadian. And there was also, of course, the sonar crewman, who was a very experienced, one of the best sonar crewmen, leading seaman in the Navy. And my commanding officer asked me to go and see the sonar crewman's wife and break the news to her. And I will never forget that. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. I arrived outside her front door. She was expecting her husband back from night flying, and I had to break the news to her. And we then had to go through four funerals, and we then had to go through the inquiry. And I, of course, was really on the line, because I was the briefing officer. And I was exonerated, but I took the opportunity to slam the training system, because what had happened was they had cut corners in order to save costs. It's very expensive to train a Sea King observer, and under pressure of costs, they had allowed this marginal chap to go through, and he had killed himself and three others, and the only beneficiaries of all this was the arms trade, I realised. Westland were ordered to provide another Sea King. And that really lodged in my consciousness. And, of course, they did the right thing by me subsequently. They sent me my next job to be senior observer of the training squadron. And I was given carte blanche to chop all subsequent trainee observers, even if it was the last week. And I was ruthless about it, because I had seen what had happened. And that what I believe had gone on was that we'd also gone through several hurricanes, storms, in which the Sea Kings had really proved themselves in terms of search and rescue. This has never happened before. No helicopter could have survived in those conditions. And it was our squadron particularly that had gained a lot of publicity for this, and a lot of the reflected glory, of course, had come off from the Navy. And they grew to be a sort of superhuman ability behind the Sea King. These things could do anything. They could survive weather, they could go all night, and so on and so on. And I fear that, again, this crew had become a victim of this. And it was a very, very responsible job. And because it was helicopters, it wasn't jets, it wasn't glamorous, and we were sitting in awful deck chairs in the dark for 4 hours, and it was sweaty and horrid, with hydraulic fluid pouring over us and everything, no one realised just what a responsible job the observer had in the back, and also that the sonar crewman was totally dependent, as were the two pilots to a certain extent, but it was the sonar crewman who was dependent for his life upon this observer sitting alongside him. And that a true motion radar doesn't keep any records really as such. It is purely the integrity of the man and his professionalism and what has been instilled in him. And that he must never be pushed into positions which were beyond his capability. And this man had been. And I really felt that the Navy had been found wanting. Right. So that's all the process of my radicalisation, I think. I was able to toughen up the training system, and I was pleased to see the way the Navy responded to it. And then out of that, I got another, a real leg up in terms of my career, because one of those rare special squadrons was formed in order to prove a new helicopter. And this was the Anglo-Dutch Lynx Trial Squadron 700L for the new small ship helicopter to replace the Wasp. And of course this was going to be a very exciting new development for the observers, because this was going to be a custom-built radar-fitted helicopter with the observer sitting up front alongside the pilot, given equal status almost. And I know there was a lot of intensive competition for the job of being senior observer, and I was given the job. And I'm quite sure it was, again, because of my buccaneer background, that I got a slight head start. And so I did that job, which was fascinating. A wonderful helicopter, the Lynx, in many ways. Very much a pilot's helicopter, though. It hadn't been built, designed by an observer, and there were a lot of problems, because mainly to do with the fact that you couldn't really see the plot very easily, and it was very cramped sitting up alongside the pilot. In fact, you needed to be back in the cabin, which I believe is where the latest mark of Lynx is putting the observer. He's gradually moved back into the cabin, so he's got room for his plot, and to be able to really use his skills. But it was great fun, and we did a lot of promotion of the links as well. However, there was a real crisis for me, and this is something that I have not revealed before. About a week after I got into the job, I hadn't really noticed it, and it wasn't until I looked out of the window of my office at Yeovilton and looked at a links down the hard standing, I realised that the tail rotor went round the opposite way to a Sea Kings. And my senior pilot, Colin Haig, opposite number on the test squadron, and he had been the test pilot who had taken it right through Boscombe Down and everything in its initial prototype phases. I asked him, why does the tail rotor go round the other way? And he wouldn't answer me. And I began to look at this, and I realised that this was a major cock-up. And what had happened, apparently, was that this was the second helicopter that had been specifically designed by Westland. The Wasp was the first in terms of small ship helicopters. And they had not bothered to go through their research, the research into helicopters, as to whether or not it made a difference. And it didn't for the Wasp because it was so slow. But the problem was the Lynx was a high-performance helicopter. It made no difference in the hover, but when you get to high speed, it did. And if I could just explain that what happens with a helicopter at high speed is that the tail gets cocked up. Sorry, that's a bad expression. I'll start again. It gets tipped up. I'm into the business of describing cock-ups. In order to get a vector from the main rotor pointing forward. And that gives the forward motion. But of course, the problem is that when you're moving at high speed, you get a heavy downwash passing through the tail. And so all helicopter designs until the Lynx had ensured that the tail rotor was retreating in terms of being when it was above the tail, where the main interference was going to occur. So you minimized that interference. Whereas if it was going the other way around, then you would double the interference, as the tail rotor would be actually beating into the downwash and also, of course, against the forward motion of the helicopter. And that is why I believe that the Lynx is such a noisy helicopter. You can hear it a long way before you see it. And I asked Colin Haig whether they had tried the tail rotor the other way, and he said they had, briefly, at Westland, but they hadn't sorted out the lubrication channels. It had seized in the hover after a few minutes, and they just hadn't gone on. And it was too late. There was so much loss in face by then in considering changing it. And so I was deeply concerned about this, especially as the engineers were facing mounting problems with vibration in the tail, which was clearly caused by this, and they were having to strengthen the tail. I did complain about it, and I was told to shut up. And so I did. But this troubled me. And I thought about not only the incompetence of Westland in designing it like that, but also the ability of the institution of which I was a part to not face this, the collapse of moral courage. Anyway, I don't know whether it was a factor in my being promoted out of that job to keep me quiet, but I was stunned to find that I was selected for promotion on leaving that job. And that, of course, made me effectively high and dry as a commander. It was about my second shot. I had never served in a frigate, and now I was in the rat race to drive one. and I feared that this was going to be the end for my career, because I felt I couldn't, I hadn't passed all my ship command exams, particularly navigation. I had to try and do it in evening classes, effectively. After my normal day work in my next job, which was looking after an admiral in the Ministry of Defence, which was the most hectic job I had yet had in the Navy. And I also was very concerned because I felt that because the Navy had not allowed me to get my frigate experience, and indeed I had been about to go as first lieutenant of a frigate, which was going to be tough enough, following my Lynx squadron job when they promoted me. And I went straight to the staff course and then to the Ministry of Defence. I felt that I really should go as executive officer of a guided missile destroyer, or even an aircraft carrier, in order to find my feet as a seaman officer again. And I actually wrote a letter to my appointer to that effect, and he told me to tear it up, because it showed not enough ambition. Because many an aviator in the past had apparently done just what I was being invited to do, and had ridden on the back of his team of officers while he learnt how to handle the ship and so on, and had got away with it. I argued that in fact very few observers with my lack of frigate experience, like Zero, had done that, if any, and I felt I was in a special position. And most pilots, of course, certainly helicopter pilots, had all had small ship experience in WASP flights, or in Wessex 3 flights, anti-submarine flights in guided missile destroyers. And so I felt that this was not professional. And as I say, I was told to tear it up. And that rang more alarm bells for me. And so I realized that I ought to seriously be considering my future. Because after all, if I was going to go to the top in any way, then I had to have sea command, and this was right. And I could see that with the growing rat race, because the Navy was being cut again, that my chances were very small. Anyway, I soldiered on, or sailored on, but there was another factor then that reared its head, and this was going back to the nuclear problem. I found that I was personal staff officer to a Rear Admiral in the Ministry of Defence, whose job was called Assistant Chief of Naval Staff Policy. And he was a sort of second deputy First Sea Lord, and it was a budding First Sea Lord's job, looking at the future of the Navy and the current sort of strategy. Very much a sort of intellectual officer's job, very high pressure. But on top of that, he had at that time, this was 1979, the responsibility for recommending the replacement for Polaris. And, of course, Mrs. Thatcher had just come to power, and there was an enormous expansion of all things nuclear underway. Not only looking for the replacement for Polaris, but also cruise missiles were being brought in, and there was a great expansion of nuclear power generation about to happen using an American design pressurized water reactor, which had just failed so drastically at Three Mile Island. And I think this is where I should first mention my aunt, or come up again about my aunt, Hilda Murrell, my mother's elder sister by 3 years. She had never married. She had had a very successful career running the family rose business. She was a very good businesswoman, apart from her intellectual skills, but she was a great amateur botanist, and one of the founder members of the Soil Association, so she was into organic farming, or organic horticulture anyway, And she was a great forward thinker about the environment. And I remember she had forecast the oil crisis to me 2 years before it happened. And then when it happened, she said straight away, the next crisis will be nuclear. And she began to research it. And of course, after my mother died in 1964, when I got over the bereavement, my aunt Hilda filled the vacuum, and we discovered that we were very close. We got on very well, and incidentally, my mother and she had had a great rivalry because of the favoritism showed towards Hilda by their parents, and it was one of the reasons for my mother's depression. And my mother had never allowed me to get close to Hilda while she was alive. But now I did, and there was a lot of catching up. And Hilda was a very powerful force for morality, integrity, but also great enthusiasm for the world and always looking ahead. And I therefore listened to her, and I was persuaded by her arguments. She also, I think, respected my career in the Navy, but she never challenged me about the nuclear angle. She realized this was extremely sensitive for me. But she had begun to openly campaign against nuclear power by the end of the 70s. And I remember, in fact, when I went to my last job in the Navy, which was Staff Officer Intelligence to Commander-in-Chief Fleet, I arrived there in spring of 1980. I had to have my security clearance renewed. In fact, it had to be extended. And I remember telling the chap security vetting me about Hilda, and saying that she was, in fact, a liberal politically. And I remember he sucked his pencil and noted that down. But that we had not discussed nuclear weapons at all. She was opposing nuclear power generation only. And I thought that he ought to know. And he thanked me, and I got the clearance. I think I also said that I was pretty sympathetic towards the liberals as well, myself. And that was very daring, of course, not to be a conservative as a commander. There were a few I remember around, and we all felt rather brave and radical. And I read The Guardian and so on. Anyway, I was reassured because the admiral that I began working for in Northwood then was Admiral Eberly, and he read The Guardian too, so I felt I was reasonably safe. Anyway, that was the first time I think the authorities ever openly heard about concerns that I had about nuclear power. And I had agreed, I think before then, that nuclear power was a mistake, certainly the state at which it was at in Britain. And then, of course, Three Mile Island had happened. And this was the great new hope for the nuclear power industry in this country. Out of the frying pan into the fire. However, there was this other problem now about Trident. And I had been a fly on the wall in the Ministry of Defence as the papers had come across my desk to my admiral, as the naval staff had debated the replacement for Polaris. And I had watched the nuclear submarine lobby go ruthlessly for Trident because of their vested interest, even if it meant terminal damage to the rest of the Royal Navy. And I was particularly concerned that there was no debate about pulling out of the nuclear weapon game at that point, which we could have done with great honour. We could have turned it into a virtue. We were not in the superpower league, and we could have just gracefully shown the world the way out. But instead, we were hooked on this thing, and I really felt that Mrs. Thatcher was a nuclear junkie, and that therefore if Polaris was heroin, then Trident was crack. And she, of course, was dazzled by the nuclear boys, who were not only running Polaris, but of course were doing derring-do missions up into the Barents Sea, and having Cold War games. And I was also concerned that the nuclear submarine industry had not provided any solution for decommissioning a nuclear submarine. They were proceeding with new construction, openly sidestepping this problem altogether. And I thought that was very irresponsible. I also was concerned about the environmental implications of a nuclear submarine being torpedoed in its reactor, let alone a Polaris submarine being torpedoed. And there was no concern about this. There was a general feeling of gung-ho and let's get on with it and it's a great toy. I did not think this was very mature. I also was particularly concerned, of course, for the surface fleet. And I do recall the director of naval plans at that time, one Captain Sandy Woodward, who I got to know very well and who worked directly to my admiral, and he was a nuclear submariner, actually recommending against Trident because of the damage it would do to the surface fleet. I reminded him of this when I found myself up against him on an ITV programme as HMS Vanguard. The first Trident submarine was being wheeled out, and he told me not to mention it.
But what was this damage to the surface fleet?
Well, what it was that, of course, not only was Trident much more expensive than Polaris, but by then the rest of the fleet had shrunk to by a greater proportion. And I'm comparing it to when Polaris was introduced to the Navy, which was in, 1968, about. And so proportion of the budget, whatever the naval budgeteers will argue, I refuse to believe that there was an extra tranche specifically allocated for Trident. There may have been a little, but I have got it on good authority that there was an enormous chunk of the naval budget being allocated to Trident, and let's face it, the other two services were never going to allow the Navy to get away with a special strategic tranche, and something else was going to have to go. And especially the Royal Air Force was never going to allow the Navy to get away with having nicked the nuclear deterrent from them with Polaris, then to be able to go one step further with Trident. And here was the Royal Air Force potentially in danger of extinction in the future with the great cuts in defence imminent. I could see it happening. And I believe it has come to pass that now we are seeing real cuts in the basic makeup of the Royal Navy. And I had a talk with Captain Sharp, who is editor of Jane's Fighting Ships, only about 2 months ago, in which he agreed with me, and I found it very interesting that he has consistently put in a comment under Trident ever since he took over Jane's Fighting Ships, that he was concerned about the damage that Trident was going to do to the rest of the Navy. He says now it's an old argument that has gone by. I believe it is maybe nearly too late, but it has certainly never been discussed. And that this is something that is going by default. I ought to stop, actually, because I've just seen Amy is arriving.